May it please the court, I'm Walter Sargent. I represent the plaintiffs Paul and Francine Martinez. There are two issues on appeal, and they both involve expert testimony about whether Paul Martinez was actually struck by the falling television. The trial court precluded the testimony of Paul's treating physician, but allowed testimony from GobHeaven's retained expert in engineering on the same issue. And the question now is whether the trial court abused its discretion in either or both of those rulings. I'd like to start with the testimony of the physician, Dr. Hall. For 22 months before trial, Dr. Hall had been clearly disclosed as a treating physician who would be testifying directly that Paul Martinez suffered blunt head trauma as a direct result of this incident. He was named in every list of plaintiffs' trial witnesses. Plaintiffs' counsel had specifically told defense counsel that Dr. Hall was going to testify on this issue. There's no dispute the defendants were fully aware of his testimony long before trial and never objected. And 30 minutes before trial, GobHeaven filed its objection, said the testimony was irrelevant under 401, unfair and cumulative under 403. And the trial court precluded Dr. Hall's testimony in its entirety. This is an abuse of discretion. First, as to relevance, this trial was bifurcated between liability and damages. To establish liability, plaintiffs were required to prove defendants' breach of their duty of due care and that it caused injury. GobHeaven's defense was that even if a breach of the duty of due care did cause a television to fall, it didn't cause injury because it didn't strike Paul. And Dr. Hall's testimony that Paul suffered blunt head trauma consistent with being struck by a heavy object was obviously relevant to proving that a 102-pound television set fell on his head and did cause injury. Now, regarding Rule 403, in reviewing a 403 ruling, this court is required to give the evidence the maximum probative weight and the minimum prejudicial effect. And GobHeaven said that it wouldn't be fair to allow Dr. Hall to testify without the opportunity to conduct independent medical examinations, to pose Dr. Hall, challenge his testimony with other medical experts. The defendants had 22 months to do all of these things. Now, maybe they didn't bother to do them because they didn't even dispute that Paul had been struck on the head until the last couple of months before trial. But that's no reason to preclude plaintiffs' timely disclosed expert testimony. And as for the contention that Dr. Hall's testimony was needlessly cumulative, the eyewitness testimony was remarkably conflicting, and a jury could certainly find that there was not a preponderance of the eyewitness testimony that to prove that Paul was struck on the head. So medical evidence was crucial.
Now, Mr. Sargent, what about the emergency room doctor's testimony? Did he testify that Mr. Martinez was injured as a result of blunt force trauma?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe he did. He acknowledged that the symptoms can come up at a later time, but there was certainly he was not able to testify as to any obvious head trauma. And neither the EMT or the emergency doctor could testify that there was that immediately apparent brain injury. And GobHeaven was actually using that to argue that there was no medical evidence that Paul was hit. Dr. Hall was the only witness who could counter that argument with testimony about symptoms of blunt head trauma that would not have been apparent immediately following the accident. And plaintiff's counsel offered to limit Dr. Hall's testimony to just 30 minutes, limited solely to talking about traumatic head trauma, and the trial court still refused. And that was an abuse of discretion.
Counsel, excuse me. Is there anything in the record to explain why plaintiff's counsel did not, at the close of a defendant's case, seek to call Dr. Hall?
I don't believe there's anything in the record, Your Honor. And that, I guess, brings me to the last point, because in the last paragraph of their argument on this issue, GobHeaven said that we've waived this argument because the trial court invited Mr. Martinez to revisit this issue at another time. And I don't think that's accurate, Your Honor. On the first day of trial, the court made a definitive ruling to preclude the testimony. That's sufficient to preserve the issue for appeal under Uptain, Vista Resorts, and so on. And on the second day of trial, the court said, I'm still struggling with the issue. But it ultimately, after considerable discussion, said it was going to stand on its ruling. Now, it said, if at all possible, perhaps you could keep Dr. Hall on call. I'd like to point out Dr. Hall is actually a treating physician. He wasn't a retained expert here, and there's no indication that he would have been able to come back at any other time.
Any indication that he couldn't have?
Neither way,
okay. Your Honor.
But the court did not say, did not invite the plaintiffs to raise this issue again. And even if it had, this court in Bennett versus Greeley Gas held that a party did not waive evidentiary objections or evidentiary arguments, where the trial court actually did state that they could raise this issue again at trial, depending on the evidence, because the trial court, this court said, did not require the party to do so. There's a definitive ruling, the court stood on it, the issue was not waived. I'd like to proceed to ESI's engineering testimony.
Before we get there, counsel, I have a question for you. We all recognize that the abuse of discretion standard is a very deferential standard of review, and that we can only reverse if we conclude it was a manifestly arbitrary, unreasonable, or unfair. I'm having a little bit of difficulty understanding how we can take a decision that was this agonized over by the trial court, and where the trial court listened to arguments from both sides and reconsidered his ruling at least once and determined that that was manifestly arbitrary, unfair, or unreasonable. Can you please help us with that?
Well, I guess I'd also like to point out it can be an abuse of discretion, applies the wrong legal standard and so on, but I think...
So is that in play here, the wrong legal standard?
Well, only to the extent that I think it's fair to say that, I guess I'd go back to the standard that this court is required to give the maximum probative evidence to maximum probative
weight,
and minimum prejudicial effect. And this was the only medical testimony. It's undisputed here. This is the only medical testimony that could establish that there was traumatic brain injury. And that information was used in opening statement, in closing statement, to say there's no medical evidence that he suffered any injury. So I think the prejudice is manifest, and I think it's admirable, frankly, that the trial court acknowledged it was struggling with the issue. It wasn't sure it was doing the right thing. But ultimately, it had two chances after extensive argument, and it ultimately came down saying it was excluding it. And I think it appeared to be excluding it because it was confused about that this was spilling over into damages. And of course, yes, it's relevant to damages, but it's also relevant to causation and injury, and that is necessary to establish a liability claim. I'd like to continue on ESI's engineering testimony. Unlike Dr. Hall, the engineers at ESI were retained experts. They submitted two expert reports, the first about a year before trial, the second about 45 days before trial. Expert disclosure, the second expert disclosure said that the author was Robert Butler. Butler's report concluded that it was impossible for the television to have struck Paul Martinez. Plaintiffs moved to preclude the testimony under Schreck. The trial court denied the motion, said, quote, if Dr. Butler's conclusions are as ridiculous as the plaintiffs maintain, the fact finder should have no difficulty disposing of his testimony rather expeditiously. Now, we've argued that this is an abuse of discretion, failing to perform a Schreck analysis and make appropriate findings. God Heaven has two responses. First, it says we waive the argument because we only objected to the testimony by Robert Butler, not by Robert Wynn. Well, in the briefing on the plaintiff's motion in limine, in the response and the reply, is very clear that both sides recognized that the objection was to the opinions in the document that had been originally identified as the report of Robert Butler. And it wasn't limited to just Robert Butler, it was to any of ESI's experts. And the trial court's refusal to preclude the testimony wasn't based on any findings that were specific to Butler. The denial of the motion as to Butler was sufficient to preserve the issue for appellate review, regardless of which ESI expert was actually put on the stand to present this. And I cited the case of Vista Resorts versus Goodyear Tire for that proposition. Now, Godwin's second argument is the trial court didn't have to perform a Shrek analysis. And in the recent case of People v. Rector in March of this year, the Supreme Court did say trial court may determine that a Shrek analysis isn't required if a party fails to state a specific challenge pursuant to Shrek or if the party is challenging testimony that the expert doesn't intend to present. Neither of those exceptions applies here. Plaintiffs made specific objections to four specific conclusions. As Justice Scalia noted in Kumho Tires, the trial court's discretion in choosing the manner of testing expert reliability is not discretion to abandon the gatekeeping function or discretion to perform the function inadequately. Here, the trial court simply abdicated its gatekeeping function, left it up to the jury explicitly to determine whether ESI's conclusions were, as the jury put it, as ridiculous as plaintiffs maintained. That was an abuse of discretion.
Well, how did you demonstrate that the conclusions of the ESI report were junk science? What did you put in that indicated that it was junk science, well, unreliable inherently?
Well, unreliable or under 403. I mean, 403 is part of the Shrek analysis. And part of what was put in was that the evidence, the eyewitness testimony, for example, was that the television slid off and fell on Paul.
That doesn't make the science unreliable behind the testing, does it? That's an issue for cross-examination.
There's no science in this. I mean, it was simply an engineering proposition. There's nothing more scientific about this than Newtonian mechanics. I mean, it was simply, you know, television falling off. And the question is, did it slide off, as all the eyewitnesses said, and fell on Paul, or barely missed him, as some said? Or did it, as the expert said, flip over to 360-degree turn and land 5 feet away from where they thought it was? And the trial court could look at that and say the assumptions that were made by the expert were simply not appropriate for this case. I mean, there was no evidence to support those assumptions. I mean,
how is that part of a Shrek analysis?
Under 403, Your Honor. Because the trial court may determine that it's simply confusing the jury if it's not sufficiently relevant. And it's not relevant that it flips over 360 degrees if there's no testimony that it did that, and then in fact slid over. And the testimony, and the conclusion was also that it couldn't have hit him because it couldn't have hit a flexible object like a human body and then reversed rotation and landed on the front of the, well, there was no testing in support of that. They're just saying that. And you can't just say, as Justice Scalia said, the ipsy dixit of the experts, I'm an engineer, trust me. And I think that's what they did in this case. And they, of course, the objection we have is that the court simply abdicated its responsibility to do this. The second question, of course, is, was that harmful? And we're arguing, of course, it was.
The evidence unanimous that the TV slid off as opposed to flipped off?
I'm not aware of any other evidence that it flipped over. Looking at the expert report, it appears to me that the expert read several depositions, and I'm not aware that any of those depositions said that it flipped over, and I don't think there's anything in the expert report indicating that there was any evidence that it flipped over. So I'd like to reserve the last minute of my time for rebuttal, if I may. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm Fotios Bertzos, registration number 10432. I represent defendant Gob Heaven, doing business as Extreme Pizza. I will do part of the argument, Your Honors, and I will take no more than 10 minutes of your time before counsel for Peerless Industries completes the argument for the defendants. It is our contention that the judgment of the trial court should be affirmed in this case, and I want to specifically talk about the challenge to Dr. Butler's testimony at the outset. The motion by the plaintiffs in limine, which was this purported Shrek motion, was filed 19 days before trial, and it complained, number one, about a late endorsement of Dr. Butler, and the trial court dealt with that it is abundantly clear in the record that what happened was this case was originally set for trial January of 2010. In December of 2009, the depositions of all the experts at that time had been taken, and it was obvious that they were doing different things, and there was a representation to the trial court that a continuance was requested by all the parties so that additional testing could take place and additional depositions could take place. That was done at the beginning of 2010. And in the record, it's contained letters from me to the council saying, here are some suggested protocols for the testing. And then ultimately, there's no response by the other parties. And there's an invitation to say, ESI has to do additional testing. You please let me know if you want to participate in it. And we'll just have the report done and completed and to you by April of 2010. There was never any request for them to participate in it.
Yeah, are you suggesting that they've waived their right to challenge the report because they didn't want to participate in your testing?
I'm not saying a challenge for that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is it's not a late endorsement. It was done, and there was ample notice that it was coming to them, and they also had the opportunity. Their own experts reviewed it and commented on it and testified on it. In fact, all the experts did that.
Mr. Burso, is the late endorsement being raised on appeal at all?
No. I'm just setting the groundwork here, Your Honor. This just gets us to the point where they file a Schreck motion, and I would say the motion itself doesn't really challenge the science of engineering. It simply appears to be taking issue with the fact that this new supplemental report by ESI is containing opinions that are contrary to those of the plaintiff's eyewitnesses who say the television hit Mr. Martinez. And initially, that isn't really a Schreck challenge. There's no challenge to the science. The only thing the plaintiffs did was attach some deposition transcripts and some items from another case that Dr. Butler had testified in regarding an automobile accident and said to the court, see, he always testifies contrary to what eyewitnesses say, therefore don't believe him. That's not an adequate Schreck challenge. And then they say that there should have been a dummy, a 180-pound dummy struck by a television to do a better set of testing. Well, that would be a cross-examination item to the weight of the testing as opposed to the science involved.
Could a court exclude scientific evidence on the basis that it contradicts all expected testimony from eyewitnesses based on Schreck or 403?
I guess under 403, the trial court has significant discretion, Your Honor. I'm not sure it would simply be excludable because eyewitnesses testified to if 10 eyewitnesses and they're the only eyewitnesses say that it happened this way, and there's an expert here that says it couldn't have happened this way, I'm still not sure that 403 would allow the court to simply say, you got to believe the eyewitnesses, you cannot believe the expert. But that isn't what we really have here. Here we had very contested, conflicting expert or eyewitness testimony where people said that it hit him and people said that it didn't. And a careful reading of the record shows that the people who say it did not hit Mr. Martinez had a different vantage point than those who did. And that was pointed out in the testimony, I believe, on day 5 of trial.
It's clear to me from reading the report, and I'm not an engineer, I'll quickly admit, but that there was any explanation for or any statement of basis for the statement that a reversal of the rotation would not have occurred if it had hit a body. Was there something in the record to support that finding, that conclusion, which I believe was testified to by...
It was actually testified to by Dr. Nguyen. He went through the opinions on, I believe, day 5.
I'm talking about the report, I'm sorry.
Oh, on the report. I don't remember the report in detail, but I believe what the report contains is, this is the additional material that was reviewed by the experts, this is the testing that was done, and these are the conclusions based on the testing. So in that way, there would be an explanation, because it would be embodied in their testing and all the additional material they read.
Testing didn't involve having it hit flexible 180-pound body?
No, none of the testing by any of the experts did that.
I understand that. So how do they, how does the, I didn't see how the report reached that conclusion. I saw it state that.
Yeah.
But I didn't see anything in the report that provided a basis for that.
I don't know if there is it in the report. It is clearly in the trial testimony because Dr. Nguyen walked point by point by point to the jury about each one of those, I believe there are 11 opinions, and then he's cross-examined on those opinions as well. So he has an explanation in there about his report. So I can't answer your question without having that committed to memory, but I don't remember that in the report. Mr. Railsback, who was the expert for the plaintiffs, also reviewed the supplemental report. He did basically the same sort of testing as the defendant's experts, and he just simply came to a different conclusion about whether or not it could have struck this individual. He did not, however, challenge ESI's analysis of where the soda machine was and where the plaintiff really was in relation to the soda machine. So he's basically, in some ways, supporting the defendant's position other than a couple of tweaks he's making with it. The plaintiffs also took the deposition of Dr. Butler before trial, so they had that explanation. And then a detailed reading. What the plaintiffs really complained of in their Schreck motion were opinions 8 through 11 in the ESI report. And when you look at the direct examination of Dr. Butler at trial, he wasn't even testifying about those. The only actual opinion he really talked about was the issue about could people hang on the arm of the television stand and cause it to either tip over or later tip over due to some kind of elastic or plastic deformation. And that's what he was really talking about, as well as showing some of the testing that was done. The opinions that were challenged in the Schreck motion weren't even given by Dr. Butler. They were given by Dr. Nguyen. And the motion itself was directed to Dr. Butler, not to the ESI report. And to the extent it was directed to the ESI report, it also just basically attached as an exhibit to it saying, here's a report or an article, I believe by a PhD, see, it wasn't even someone in the same specialty, just an epidemiologist, and just said to the trial court, here's an article by an epidemiologist, why don't you use this to strike this testimony? And that isn't a proper Schreck showing. And in Schreck, the court is given the option of deciding how many factors, if any, of the Schreck analysis it actually has to use to do a Rule 702 evaluation. So the plaintiffs had an inappropriate motion, if you will, an unsupported motion at the beginning. Also, I wish to point out that Mr. Finocchiario, the expert for the co-defendant, opined at trial and in a supplemental report about the ESI report of April 9, 2010, including this opinion as to whether or not this television struck Mr. Martinez. And he said, I've now had an opportunity to review that report and look, and there is deposition testimony by an eyewitness to support the scenario that the television did not hit Mr. Martinez, and we cannot rule out that scenario. And that opinion was testified to without any objection by the plaintiffs. So there is no prejudice to the plaintiffs in this case. They allowed everything to come in, and it wasn't even a proper Schreck challenge. And before I conclude my portion of this, Your Honor, I wish to point out that it was the plaintiffs who agreed that the central issue in this case would be, at least a threshold issue, did this television even strike Mr. Martinez? Not whether it injured him. Did it strike him at all? And there was ample eyewitness testimony to support the verdict that it did not strike him at all.
You, at your motion, the judge excluded the testimony they wanted to show that he was struck by a blunt object. So isn't that kind of a problem for you?
Well, I'm going to have Mr. Lutz explain that, but my position is
you can let him do it.
It's not a real problem for me because, unlike what the plaintiffs are saying, Dr. Hall was the first time he turned up on a witness list was a month before trial. Yes, he may have been in the disclosures along with 25 other people who were medical professionals who were supposed to testify that he had suffered a brain injury. But this case was bifurcated, and on the original set of witness lists, which for the trial that was coming up in January of 2010, Dr. Hall was nowhere to be found. It was only in April of 2010 that he turned up on a trial witness list that he was going to come and testify. And Mr. Lutzel explained about the court conference, but the defendants made it very clear to the court that this was a slippery slope and that they had some problems with this because the plaintiffs were trying to use medical testimony to back into a proposition, which was improper to try to back into, and no one had done independent medical examinations. And I would point out that it came out at trial that the plaintiff actually had post-traumatic stress disorder before this incident, because the court gave the plaintiffs a lot of leeway as it was to get in medical testimony and a claim that he suffered a traumatic brain injury. So unlike what the plaintiffs say in their brief, there are other explanations as to why he may be behaving strangely if he was after the accident. But I'll let Mr. Lutz explain that to you.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Lutz, registration number 8379, and I represent the defendant Peerless Industries in this case. And we had a trial readiness conference on April 26th in front of the judge, and all three counsel were there. And by that point, it had become clear that one of the primary defenses in the case was that the TV had not struck Mr. Martinez at all, and that was based upon eyewitness testimony and by the report that had been authored by ESI. So at that time, Mr. Hurd, and we always test this, discussed, well, you know, we've got these eyewitnesses that are going to say certain things, and we have some that will say it hit him, some that say it didn't, but I feel like my best witness in terms of showing that it did strike Mr. Martinez would be Dr. Tim Hall, who's treated him for the last 4 years and can testify that while I may have been fooled by somebody, you know, once or twice, nobody's ever fooled me over a four-year period, and that in essence Dr. Hall would be able to testify that the symptomatology expressed by Mr. Martinez during that time frame was consistent with a closed head injury. There was also the discussion at that point of, are there other people, bearing in mind that we had this bifurcated between liability and damages, are there other people that could also do that, that wouldn't encroach onto the damages aspect? Because part of what Dr. Hall was going to testify to is, you know, he's had these symptoms for 4 years, they've prevented him from doing this, that, and the other thing, which started getting into that slippery slope, if you will, as it came to be termed, of damages type testimony.
Mr. Lutz, if I could interrupt you.
Sure.
Was Dr. Hall's testimony, or would Dr. Hall's testimony have been relevant to the issue of causation?
I don't think it would have.
Is causation something, let me just back up one
sure.
question, is causation something that would be appropriately determined as part of the trial on liability?
The trial of liability, we were very, very careful to have the instructions all orient to did the TV strike Mr. Martinez, not did the TV injure Mr. Martinez, not did it cause a certain kind of injury. We didn't even orient the instructions to whether it struck him on the head. It was whether it struck him at all. So the jury, and that was specifically done because we knew we were walking this tightrope, if you will, between the extent to which he was injured, which would spill into the damages aspect, and whether he was hit at all. So we crafted amongst us and the judge instructions that just talk about did it hit him, did it hit him, did it hit him. It could have hit him anywhere. Dr. Hall, in my opinion, it was, they're trying to bootstrap, if you will, through his testimony that this man had exhibited certain symptoms over a four-year period, the fact that he had been hit in the head in the first place. To my way of thinking, that's very similar to, you've got a pedestrian in a crosswalk, the issue in the liability phase is did the car hit him at all or not, and you've got a doctor that says, well, he's got a bad knee injury that was, you know, likely caused by being struck by an automobile. We're really trying to bootstrap the fact that he was hit in the head.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Oh, okay, thank you. I was just getting going. Thank you, guys.
Judge Terry asked about the legal error on the first issue, and I think that the last discussion illustrated this. There was a confusion about what the elements of liability are, and this distinction between liability and damages. The judge said we'd be litigating damages if we allowed this testimony in. Well, no, we wouldn't. We're litigating liability, which includes causation and injury. Yes, it's relevant to damages, but that doesn't mean you exclude it from an argument on liability. And causation in this case had really two components. One is, did the negligence cause the television to fall? And second was, did the television hit it? And you have to establish both of those in order to win causation.
Counsel, does the trial court have discretion to construe and interpret its own orders, such as the order of bifurcation and the stipulation, or do we review that de novo in this court?
I would think this court would review it de novo. And Mr. Letts did say, and we have it in Appendix B of the reply brief, Mr. Letts did mention in the pretrial conference that, in fact, he had proposed that it be bifurcated a different way. He proposed that at the pretrial ruling, and the trial court denied that because he said we'd have this other issue floating out there.
Also, your time has expired, but Judge Miller, have you had your question
answered? Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments, and the case will stand submitted. A written opinion will issue in due course.